If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Millie Cawthorne. On today's episode, we have another in our recorded lecture series from our autumn 2019 history events. This time, it's Professor Barry Cunliffe talking about the Scythians, following the publication of his book, The Scythians, Nomad Warriors of the Steppe. While we're not currently holding live events, we are running a series of fortnightly virtual lectures on various different historical subjects. You can find out more about them on our website at historyextra.com/events. Now, here's Professor Cunliffe, taking us on a fascinating tour of this remarkable nomadic society.
Now, the Scythians, you'll see the subheading on that book, Nomad Warriors of the Steppe, because people in the West, west of Europe, I mean, on the whole, don't know very much about the Scythians. It's not within our general knowledge. If you want to find Scythian material in museums, you'd be pretty hard put to it. There's a small collection tucked away in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, but not much more anywhere else. We don't have Scythian collections. And some of you, I suspect, will have seen that fabulous exhibition that the British Museum put on about, what, 2-3 years ago on the Scythians. But before that, the only other time there was any exhibition on the Scythians in Britain was 1978. So we are really starved, I think, of good information, up-to-date information, about who these very remarkable people were. The Greek historian Ephorus, writing in the 4th century, said that the Scythians were one of the four great barbarian peoples of the world known to the Greeks. So one of the four great barbarian peoples. We know about the Celts, a lot about the Celts. The Scythians were their near neighbours and stretched right across the steppe. And were a very, very powerful and important force, and an exceptionally interesting people. So what I want to do is just to introduce something about them, not a great deal of history, but something about them as people and their way of life. Stop. Now, is that in focus? Yeah, okay. Where did they live? They lived on the steppe. That's this green bit, this dark green bit here, that runs from, if you can get your geography, it's not an easy map to understand. There's India down there. There's the end of the Mediterranean and the Black Sea up there, and China is right over here. So the steppe extended from Manchuria through Mongolia, right across Kazakhstan to the Caspian and the Black Sea, and then a little bit of steppe ends up the westernmost bit of the steppe up here in the Great Hungarian Plain. And the area that the Scythians and Scythian-related peoples were involved in is more or less from the Altai Mountains here westwards. They didn't extend, there were different peoples over in the Mongolian steppe. So there is our geography. This is rather like a great carpet of grass sweeping across Central Asia. Now, one thing to remember particularly about this steppe is that it differed from the east to the west. In the east, particularly up here in the Altai Mountains and in Mongolia, it was particularly dry and cold. But as you began to get further and further, further west, you came into the influence of the air streams that were blowing across the Atlantic and across Europe, these milder, damper air streams. So in other words, the further west you got, the grass was greener, literally, the grass was greener. So there was always a momentum of people from this area moving. Always people were moving, and they were always moving from east across to west. And the bit that they usually ended up in was the Great Hungarian Plain. So this is one of the themes that is so important. These are people on the move. They're pastoralists. They're not agriculturalists. They're not bound to the land. They are controlled by the environment in which they live, which is this wonderful grassland sweeping right across. This is a view I took in Mongolia, but it's the same sort of grassland. This is pure steppe, wonderful steppe. We were out just one afternoon on horses just going across the steppe to get some flavour of what it was like. And writers in the 19th century, writing about the steppe, kept on saying it's one of these endless places. You can't stop in the steppe. It draws you on, it draws you on, it draws you on all the time. Movement is what the steppe is about. And these people were about movement, as we will see. And if you're on a horse here, you know, you look across this fantastic sweep of grassland and you want to move. You want to go on and you want to go on and you want to go on. There's nothing stopping you. You're drawn on the whole time. Now, the other thing about the steppe is that this was the natural environment of wild horses. The horse was the prime animal of the steppe, and it served people in absolutely every way. Horses' milk. If anyone's been to Mongolia, you will have drunk the fermented ass's milk or horse's milk, which is, I was going to say a delight, but it's a surprise anyway. The horse provided milk, it provided meat, and after about the fourth millennium BC, it provided traction. So until about the fourth millennium, people were herding horses and other animals on the steppe, but essentially on foot. And then sometime in the middle of the fourth millennium, some bright lad had the idea of jumping on one of these horses and found that it worked really rather well and that you could go much further and much faster on horseback. So that whole business of riding starts in the steppe way back in the fourth millennium. But until you get to about 1000 BC, until then, the The economy, essentially, was following animals. It was a simple economy. The animals provided everything you needed, and you were able to trade with neighbours to get the things you couldn't get from the animals in your environment. But it was a simple economy of mobile pastoralists. Then, in about 1000 BC, 1900 BC, there was quite an important change in climate. And climate change, which we all talk about these days, is vitally important in understanding the past. In this area, well, I can explain it, why climate change is so important. This is a little, the map is a bit of the Altai Mountains, that mountainous bit that broke up the steppe. And what you see there is the river valley, the Minusinsk Valley, this is the Minusinsk Basin, with areas of steppe, sort of pasture land, good, rich pasture land with mountains around. So you've got various areas of steppe land. And it shows you there the burial mounds in the steppe land. Now, it was probably in this area and adjacent areas, and geographically we're in Siberia now, southern Siberia. It was in this area that society began to change, because the climate changed quite fast here in the 10th, 9th centuries. And what happened was it became a lot moister and a lot warmer. And that meant that the grass grew much more lushly, and life became easier. And with easy life, population grew and grew and grew. And with the growth of population sort of takes off in a particular area, population growth takes off, and it has a momentum. And quite often it takes you beyond the holding capacity of the land, and the land can no longer support you. And what happens here is you find the development of what I've called a predatory society, a society that is no longer a simple pastoral society, but one that takes to warfare and takes to raiding, and that the bands of young men now, because life is comparatively easy, but they're under pressure, tend to take off and start raiding neighbours and bringing animals and wives and things back to their homeland, and then going off and raiding again. So this is the beginning. Climate change here creates a change in society that makes it warlike. And the horse, of course, is absolutely crucial. And this is really where the Scythian way of life starts, in this basin. And you can see some of the weapons here that represent this. The arrows, which are very important, these little daggers, small daggers, and this very effective weapon, the battle axe. Here's a battle axe, on would have been on a long stick, very effective for sort of making holes in people's heads. When you're sort of riding with your horse, you've got a long-handled battle axe, you can take a swipe at them, and very effective. And you do actually find skulls with holes in about the size of battle axe ends, so you know that they were being used. So here's the archaeology of this predatory society. And we find, too, that some people were getting richer and richer and richer and more powerful in society, presumably because they were successful at raiding. And so you get a hierarchy building up. Once you've got a hierarchy in society, then the young men at the lower end of that hierarchy want to aspire to the upper end, and this sort of exacerbates the development of this predatory way of life. Now, we see this hierarchy brilliantly in this grave. It's a place called Artand, and it's in, this is Artand 1, and it's in Siberia, southern Siberia. And you can see in the plan what it is. This is a plan of a barrow, a mound, a big burial mound, which is about 60, 70 kilometers, meters across. There's a chamber, a wooden chamber in the center, and this sort of structure of timbers coming all the way out. And the whole thing was covered by a low mound. Now, in the center, You have a grave chamber there, which had the chieftain in it. And around him, these were the graves, the coffins of his retainers, all the people who were used to him, who were killed, presumably at the time of his death, so that they could accompany him to the afterlife. And here were his horses were placed. And here's some of the wonderful art that is associated with this burial, this animal sort of biting its own backside, recurved on itself. And this is a theme that runs through Scythian art. And just a few facts. These timbers, for example, were 100-year-old timbers when they were cut, and there were about 6,000 of them. So 6,000 100-year-old trees were cut down just to make that structure. That involved a great deal of effort and manpower, person power. And then within the compartments, there were horses. You can see some of them shown with their gear. 150 horses were brought in here, in addition to his own special horses. 150 were brought in and slaughtered and just buried in this grave. So you get some idea of how important this person was. Right at the top, a king, a chief, or something like that. And the fascinating thing about the horses that were brought in is that they had very distinctive horse gear, and archaeologists can show that they were not necessarily, not all local horses at all, that many of them were being brought in from kilometres and kilometres away. So here was a person who had power over huge areas, and when he died, his wife or female was killed, his servants were killed, his horses were killed, and then all the people from countryside all around brought in gifts of horses and things of value, which were buried in his grave. So here is the kind of society you see developing. This is 9th century AD, BC. And then this is in the same cemetery. This is Artanda II. An excavation going on now. You can see it was only a few years ago, that excavation. The importance of this one is that the grave chamber, which you can just about see there, was completely intact. In Artand 1, it had been robbed out. And here, the grave is intact. There are the timbers of the grave, and there is the chieftain and his female companion lying there, absolutely covered in gold and precious stones. Masses and masses of gold, some big pieces of gold, but his cloak was sewn with little animals in gold, about a centimetre long. They were stitched on to presumably the fabric of his clothing, so he would have just glittered as he moved. And I was, in the research for this book, I was in the museum in St. Petersburg, in the Hermitage Museum, and I was actually in the office of the archaeologist who had dug this grave, and talking to him about it, a man called Juganov. And I was asking about these little figures, and I was asking were they mass-produced or were they individually produced and so on. And he said, well, would you like to see them? And I said, yes, please. And it was an ordinary old office, you know, a normal sort of office. And he had a rather battered filing cabinet there. So he pulled out the drawer in the filing cabinet and took out a box, took the lid off, and there they all were, hundreds of these little Scythian gold animals. And we spent ages, wonderful time, one of the most exciting times in my life, picking them up and looking at them and comparing them to see whether they were mass-produced or not. You know, you can relate to these people and their lives through their artifacts very, very, very closely, very well. Now, we've been talking so far of the Scythian-related peoples who started off this sort of great flood of mobile raiding horsemen. And then that continues for 1,000 years. And constantly you get, as I say, this movement from the east, from somewhere up here. We were talking about that area up there, right across Asia to the Black Sea, and then eventually beyond the Black Sea. Now, there is a slight complication here in that the people have got different names. And this is the world as it was seen by, say, the Greeks and the Persians about 500 BC. The Greeks, of course, lived, well, Greece is down, just off the map, but the Greeks controlled this area and they controlled the Black Sea, the fringe of the Black Sea. So they were in direct relation to the Scythian peoples there. And then at the same time, the Persians had conquered this whole area. The Persians, starting off in Iran here, had conquered this area. And they were controlling these people called Saka, who the Persians say are the same as the Scythians. So they had different names. So in other words, we are dealing with a very similar lot of people who were known by different names, but they were all very, very similar indeed. And these are the names that the Greeks knew. They had some idea of geography. And there were Greek travellers going through this area and bringing back information. You see, they've got proper names here for some of these people. And then they begin to tail off. So you haven't, they don't know what these people are called, but they were gold-guarding griffins. This is what the Greeks thought they were. These are the sort of travellers' tales coming back. So the further away you are from Greece, the less you know about the people. Now, what we find is that, as I say, these people, these Saka were Sidones and Massageti and all the rest on Sauromati, were all very, very similar. And the situation you hear of is that people move, Greek writers tell us that these people moved into the territory of these, that knocked these people on and they moved on a bit further and then these moved and attacked the Scythians, the royal Scythians, and so on. There was a sort of constant domino falling effect of people moving from the east and shoving out their neighbours and them moving into the next area and them moving into the next area. And this went on all the way through the first millennium BC. And it makes it very difficult to write a history of this because all we've got is what the Persians and the Greeks began to learn about it. But we can very much write an archaeology and an anthropology. Now, one of the earliest groups of Scythians the Greeks tell us about moved from somewhere up here. And they moved down into this area. That's the Caucasus Mountains. So they moved north of the Caucasus and into the Pontic Steppe. So the Greeks tell us about this. So this is an historic fact. And here is this group that has moved into, there's the Caucasus Mountains, moved into that area. The green are their tombs. And the arrows show where they moved, where some of them moved. And the Greeks write about this, and so do the Assyrians. The Assyrians who were occupying this area, were being this area here, were being attacked by the people here from Urartu. So there was a massive battle going on. And the Scythians, for them, this was great. You know, there was action south of the Caucasus. So what did they do? They jumped on their horses and they came through and they offered their services to the Urartians and to the Assyrians in their battle. So we hear about them. They're mentioned in clay tablets and mentioned by the Greeks and so on. So this is where we first pick up our information about them. And we know, too, that some of them will have just done it for the season, you know, when there was nothing to do after a dull winter. You get on your horse, you go through the Caucasus and start beating people up and looting, and then you go back home again. Some of them stayed for longer. And there was one group that we were told stayed for longer. They stayed for 28 years down here fighting. And then when they went back, their wives weren't particularly pleased about this. These hoary old battle-scarred warriors coming back after 28 years. Their wives had married all the servants and so on and had children of their own. So there was a confrontation. And the young men of the homeland confronted their fathers and grandfathers and tried to stop them coming home. And there was a big battle that the Greeks write about. The old men won, I'm glad to say. But when they were down here, they related to the people of Urartu, and the craftsmen who were making weapons down here started making weapons for the Assyrians and probably went back with them. So we get these wonderful, fabulous beasts, sort of part fish, part deer, part human. decorating this wonderful sword in gold, a gold scabbard, made presumably by a craftsman down here, but found in a burial up here. So they were using the craftsmen and ideas of the people they came into contact with. Some of them settled, some of these people settled in, oh, that's the lot we were looking at there in the Caucasus. Others settled here in the steppe, what is now Ukraine and the Crimea. And some went through the steppe into the what's called the forest steppe, the edge of it. And these different colours just represent archaeologically distinct groups of Scythians. So there was no sort of one group. There were lots of different groups, and their archaeology is all just slightly different, and their economies are slightly different. And some of them actually moved through the Carpathian Mountains here into Transylvania, into Romania, and settled, and others moved over further into the Great Hungarian Plain and settled. And those are the westernmost Scythians that we find. So what we know about particularly are this lot here, because the Greeks lived all the way around the Black Sea and were in contact with them. Now, here are some images. The horse was of crucial importance, and on this lovely, it's a big sort of jug from Chertomlik, you see people, Scythians, relating to horses. The horse was so important. There's a chap down there hobbling his horse so he can't move. There's one up there trying to train it to kneel down and lie down. And this sort of horse training session is there around the top of the jug. You see, too, the typical Scythian here with long hair and beard and wearing trousers. Of course, he's a horseman. He wears trousers. He's got soft boots on. And he has a sort of long cloak. You can see it particularly on this one, a good horse riding cloak that sort of covers your legs but doesn't get in the way of them when you're on your horse. And there are these two wonderful gold plaques, again, showing typical Scythians with their dress, a sort of quilted, probably made of skins, hides, and felt to make it warm. And you get this idea of sort of quilting on their coats and their soft shoes and so on, and spearing things. And it reminds us that one of their great delights was chasing hares and across the steppe and trying to kill them. And here you can see a hare sort of trying to hide in the corner of this plaque while this guy is about to throw his spear at it. There is a famous story told when the Scythian group of Scythians meet Darius the Great, the Persian king Darius the Great, in the steppe. And Darius is sort of chasing them, and they're moving away all the time. And Darius is really fed up because he wanted a good pitch battle with them. And eventually they came together for a pitch battle. It looked to the Scythians were ready to attack him. And he reckoned he would do well in that sort of confrontation. And a hare ran in front of the Scythian warriors. And they forgot about the Persians and started chasing the hare, much to the annoyance of the Persians who had lost their, didn't have their battle after all, couldn't get people to confront them. So the archaeology, the classical texts, nicely combine to give us an impression of these people. Now, the bow and arrow was of crucial importance to them. There is the bow. It's a recurved bow. That's it. It's made of strips of wood and bone glued together. And that's the natural shape of it. And then to string it, you've got to sort of bend it back, and the string is under immense tension. And so is the string when you pull it. And we've got this wonderful picture here of a Scythian. She's wearing a sort of pointed helmet, pointed hat. There are his soft shoes and his trousers and so on, a typical Scythian. And he's stringing his bow. And he's got his bow here. He's got it in one hand. He's got it on his right leg, and he's using his left leg to push the bow down so he can string it across. It shows us how he's doing it. We know that they carried their bows and arrows in a thing called a goretus. Here's a goretus, which is a sort of quiver and bow case combined. And there is a bow sticking out. Here you can see it better on this little coin, the Garitas by the side, where the arrows were in the front and the bow was in the top. And you could whip it up quite quickly with your right hand when you needed it and shove it back in again. It was a short bow, I should stress. You need a short bow if you're riding horses. The arrows, we find the arrowheads made of bronze. They are multi-lobate, tri-lobate quite often. This little group has got a rather clever little hook attached to it. So that if you're fighting and you've got two or three of these arrows stuck in you and you pull them out, you sort of rip the wound open, and it's quite an effective form of attack using arrows. They also, so Herodotus tells us, knew how to make poison. They had poisoned arrows. And what they did was to get poisonous snakes, female snakes, when they were pregnant. So their venom was really tough, strong. And they would get the venom out of the snakes and tip it into the cauldrons of blood and then just leave them buried in the ground for weeks to ferment and so on. And the resulting liquor after a few weeks was really noxious, so they dipped their arrows in it and that would kill anyone straight away. They were effective fighters. We saw him stringing his bow. The interesting thing is he's already got his bow in his Garitas there. You can just see it. So he's stringing a bow for someone else or showing them how to do it. This comes from this lovely little gold beaker from Kul-Oba on the Black Sea coast. And the other scenes from it are fantastic. Here is one bandaging the leg of another. Here are two in sort of friendly relationship. This one is almost sort of patting the foot of his friend there. And here, this fantastic scene. Goodness knows what he's doing, but he's probably helping his friend up with toothache or something like that. So all the little scenes here are of companionship, which is a very important part of the social system in the Scythian world. To have a blood brother was extremely important, particularly if you went into battle. You always had someone looking out for you if you had a blood brother. And this scene here, not a couple of drunken yobs. These are two Scythians engaged in becoming blood brothers. And again, we have the description of how they do it. They cut their wrists and bleed into a container, a cup, or a horn of wine, and then they both drink together from the horn of wine, and in that way they become blood brothers. But as I say, this is incredibly important if you're leading this way of life and you go into battle. There is always a friend somewhere who is watching your back while you're watching the backs of your friends, and that gives you a security in the fighting.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. and BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Now, let's leave that bit for a moment and move back into the Altai Mountains. This is back into southern Siberia, where the archaeology is amazing. This is the actual area of a place called Pazirik, which is a cemetery, just a cemetery. Here's lovely steppe, and then it goes into woodland, as you see. And there is one of the barrows, the kurgans, a burial mound of a Scythian. What we find when it's excavated, these were excavated in the 1930s and again in the mid-1940s. In between that time, the archaeologists had been imprisoned by Stalin and then they were let out again. I don't know what they'd done wrong, but so there are two periods of excavation. What they found were, if you look through this at this section here, there was a pit dug in the ground, and in that pit there was a sort of log cabin constructed. We've seen that in other graves. Log cabin constructed there. Here is the log cabin. Between the log cabin and the edge of the pit, all your goods, all the goods of the dead person are packed. This is a wheeled vehicle and lots of other things. Yeah, so all your worldly goods are packed around there, and you have your own very personal things in the log cabin. Now, what is very important about this site is that the land at the moment and until now has been what is called permafrost, in that when the ground freezes in the winter and freezes to a very considerable depth, several meters depth, during the summer, it will thaw out. But if you build a mound over it, it insulates it, so the ground underneath that mound never thaws out. And that is very important, because it means that everything buried in these graves has been, as it were, in a deep freeze since it was put in the ground about 400 BC, and it is perfectly preserved. Why this is, you can see how it is important. You've got all this material that you don't have anywhere else, all the organic material. But the problem is, of course, with global warming, the permafrost is beginning to unfreeze, so that gradually all these graves that are so perfectly preserved, and there are lots of cemeteries in this area, all the organic material, once the climate gets warmer, will start to rot. So there'll be lots of jobs for archaeologists out in Siberia if you ever want one. The preservation is, as I say, extremely good. And even the bodies are preserved. These are archive photographs of the 1930s. And you can see that one. There is the human with his toes poking out. Pretty well preserved. The head, well preserved. In his wooden coffin, carved from a single tree trunk. And here is a female from one of the burials. And you can see she's been sliced down the back and across the shoulders. And then sewn up again, roughly sewn up again. And inside, some of the muscle tissue was taken away, but the organs were removed, and she was stuffed with straw and herbs and so on. And Herodotus tells us about this on the steppe, a wonderful description of how when the king dies, they open up the body and they take out the bits that are going to rot quickly, and they fill him up with nice-smelling herbs and so on, and sew him up. And then in that area, they carry him from one tribe to another, to another, to another, so that all the tribes can see that the king is dead. It's very important for people to know that the king is dead, so that they can cope with a change of rule. It's rather like kings and queens of England until, well, Queen Mother, in fact, lying in state. It's the same idea as lying in state. You see that the monarch is dead. Another reason why it was may have been done in the Altai Mountains is if you died in the winter, no one could dig a hole to bury you. So you had to hang around until the ground was soft enough in the summer for the burial to take place. So you may well have had to store grandfather for, you know, several months. And this was a better way to store them than just as complete bodies. So we learn a lot about how they viewed the body, how important the body was, certainly the sort of the way in which the body was used to tell stories, perhaps, and to proclaim history. I think we can understand that from our perspectives as well. Some of the bodies, the skin was perfectly preserved, and they were tattooed, heavily tattooed. There is a brilliant example, again from Pazirik, where you see the tattoos drawn out. Not all the skin was preserved, but the shoulders, particularly in one of the legs, were very well preserved and heavily tattooed. And here is a bit of his shoulder. This is actually his skin. And you can see here, if you can make it out, there is the head of a deer, a cervid of some sort, and probably a deer. And there is its front leg. And there is its body turned around with its two back legs there, and its tail, and its horns, antlers, sorry, spreading right across the back in a sort of symbolic way. So this animal is turned into a very energetic piece of design. And many of the other animals are like that. They're not just straight representations of animals. They're animals in contorted, tense positions. Now, this guy going round, if his tattoos were exposed, people would be able to learn a lot about him. People who knew would be able to read him, because these tattoos presumably related to his heritage and his associations with other tribes, possibly his marriage relationships, and so on. His history would have been put on his body so that people could read it. Rather better than sort of Bill Loves Mary, but it's, it really is a way of communicating, which we forget about. And a person moving from one place to another would communicate that style of art. So you can see how art could move very, very quickly. I was told a story recently, and I can't remember the name of the thing. Those little boxes of black and white squares, what are they called? It's rather like a barcode, but it's not a barcode. You know, the sort of thing that you can photograph with your phone.
QR.
Right, those. Well, someone I heard was making T-shirts, personalised T-shirts, so that young people going to parties could have all their information about themselves encrypted on one of those, on the back of their T-shirts. So that if you saw someone you rather liked the look of, you would sort of take a photograph of that and find out all about them. And this is absolutely real. It's very similar to this. It's communicating a lot about yourself. And I suppose we all do it, to some extent, in the way we wear jewellery or dress or have our haircuts or so on. We're always trying to communicate about ourselves. Well, that's a form of communication. Still in Pazirik, wonderful things preserved. This is a saddle cloth you see with these beautiful animals set on it, sewn onto it, and tassels of horsehair, brilliantly coloured. And here, a bridle, there's the bit, but all of intricately carved wood. And all of this, of course, we wouldn't get in a normal sort of archaeological context. It's only because these things are preserved by the frost that we get them. Also a cloak, a fine cloak made of pine marten and sable, little strips of fur sewn together with elaborate decoration on it. And here, this remarkable shoe with, in the sole, inset pieces of marcasite, that's, you know, fool's gold, that shiny gold-like mineral. And it's a reminder, of course, that people sat on the floor and the soles of their feet showed if you were squatting on the floor. So you decorate those as well. So this is sort of indoor wear, but it shows your position in society. And then this remarkable thing, a bronze container with burnt stones in it, in a sort of tent. Herodotus talks about these things, and this tent would have a skin on it, and in there, and you would put your head inside under the skin, or go inside if it was big enough, and on those burning stones, you would throw seeds of hemp. And here are the seeds of hemp that were found, and there is the container for the hemp seeds. And you would sort of get high on the hemp. And Herodotus describes this as the end of the burial ritual. When you purify yourself, after all the burial is done, you purify yourself in this way and really get a high. But it takes you from the world, this liminal world you've been working in, of the dead, back into the world of the living. Some of the great mounds that they created, we're back now on the steppe itself. Some of the great mounds were huge. This is Chertomlik, this one, a painting as it was before excavation. You can see this is another one of the great mounds with the Russians excavating. This is Sochia, I think. Solochka. And you've seen massive mounds, but this one is huge. And it's made and it's built over the burials. The burials are in these chambers underneath. But it's the mound that I'm fascinated by. They're built of turf. Not just digging any old rubble you could get from around the mound to make the mound big. You cut turves for kilometres around and bring those turves in and build the mound. For Chertomlik, this one, the top one we see, they reckon that there is a million turves have been cut to make it. These turves would have been quite big things. So imagine the number of people, or the number of people days needed to do that. And it would devastate the grassland for miles and miles and miles around. Now, why? One possibility is that what they're trying to do is to give their dead leader pasture land. They're collecting the pasture land and bringing the pasture in and piling it up over his burial. So that's his pasture land in the world to come. It's only a suggestion, but it's a tolerable one. I haven't time really to go into the gods in any detail. They did have gods. They worshipped a god of war. They worshipped these snake-bodied female deities, and we see them on gold work, but we don't know very much about them. We're not told a great deal about them, but they had these deities. And they also had a deity that we can recognize here. This is a carpet from Pazirik, where you have a goddess sitting by the tree of life and this hero riding towards her. And again, exactly the same story here on this gold from thousands of kilometers away. This is from the north, from Ukraine. There is the goddess sitting full frontal in this case. There is the tree of life. And here is the hero on his horse riding towards her. And this sort of pervades the mythology of the Scythians, the idea that there is a goddess, and it might be a snaky-tailed goddess or a seated goddess or a winged goddess, and the hero or god comes to her, and they combine and have children, And one of those children is the one that starts off the Scythians. It's the origin of the Siths. But I just wish we could know more. What we do have are these wonderful predatory scenes in the art. Here's a horse with a couple of griffins attacking it, or a deer there with a leopard, a spotted leopard, sort of goring it. And these are just sort of cutouts of felt from fabrics in Pasiric. The same story, these felines, these two felines attacking deer, or a bird attacking a deer. And this is typical of Scythian art, this predatory art, where the wild world is attacking the more domesticated world, world of the horse or the deer or something like that. They're in locked in conflict. And it does actually spread, that kind of art, into Europe with the Scythians, and it begins to pervade Celtic art as well. And there we've got a wooden roundel, just a roundel with this fierce bird. There's its wing, and there is its eye and beak, and there is another bird underneath here. So these two birds around a roundel. And here on this shield boss, there is the bird with its eye and the beak, and its wings now turned into Celtic art. Its wings there and there, and here is the other bird on the other side. So exactly the same sort of concept, about 4,000 kilometres apart. This one in the Altai Mountains, this one in the River Thames. This is the Wandsworth shield boss, the Celtic Wandsworth shield boss, just to show that this Celtic animal art, this Scythian animal art, does come into the Western European world and is well represented. Now, how does it end? The Scythians forget all the arrows at the moment. The Scythians living down here are invaded by people called Sarmatians, and then the whole lot mix up. The Sarmatians move against the Romans, so they have a fight down in this area, and so on. The Roman world takes over. The last of the Scythian-like peoples that we know about are the Alans, and the Alans lived in this pink area for a while. So they lived, they had pushed out the Scythians, but they were horse riders just like the Scythians, and they lived here. And then come the Huns from much further over, from probably Mongolia. And the Huns move in 370 AD and push out the Alans. And some of the Alans then join in the marauding hordes that in the late 4th century and early 5th century are destroying the Roman world. And if you follow the Alans here, they attack through the Alps, and they attack right across France into Iberia. So the last of these warlike, Scythian-like peoples get right over to the Atlantic seaboard. A few of them get down here into the Caucasus, and the last remaining sort of vestige of Scythian society is actually here in the North Caucasus, where the Alans sort of hold up in the mountains, and this is Ossetia now, North Ossetia in modern geography, and in the Ossetian language, you still have the Sarmatho-Scythian word. So that's where you've got the last remnant of the Scythians. So there they are in all their glory. People very different from us, very different from us. Wedded to their horses, wedded to a way of life that is very special to the steppe. And why I think they are well worth our while studying is that they do represent a way of life totally different from ours. We are sedentary people, food-producing sedentary people, and our ancestors have been for thousands of years. The Scythians were never food-producing sedentary people. They were always nomadic, and their lifestyle was nomadic, and their belief systems were nomadic. They were different from us. And we can understand ourselves, I think, as always, in opposition to others. If we understand the complexity of humans, I think we better understand ourselves. And that's a very good reason for studying the Scythians. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Barry, for that really, really interesting talk. Did anyone see the British Museum exhibition?
Yes.
Excellent. So you've seen some of it up close already. Would anyone like to ask a question of Barry? If so, Emma, if we go to the one lowest down first.
Thank you. I have a feeling the question's going to be part of your start, which says we know very little about them in the West, so forgive me for this.
Yeah.
I've got a picture of the pastoral time when people are moving from east to west, but undoubtedly they're not moving the whole way, they're moving little bits at a time. I've then got the picture of the predatory time when they then divide into their tribes. In that context, why are we treating them as one people?
That's a very good question. It's not easy to answer. What I would say is that the art styles from the Altai Mountains right across to the Great Hungarian Plain are very, very similar. The weapon sets are similar. Everything we know about them, all these people that were known by different names by the classical writers, have these marked similarities. And as I think I mentioned, when the Persians were talking about the Sarka, they actually took the trouble to say, well, they're just like your Scythians. You know, it's just another word for Scythians. So I think the model we ought to have is of this great sort of tide of horse riding peoples, with dominant clans who sort of move into other people's territories and take over that territory as their own. But that ruling clan is a small clan, and they might give their name to that territory, replacing that of others. We've got that hint of that under as the royal Siths, as you probably notice on one of those maps. There was a royal tribe of Scythians. So that was one of the top clans who gave their name. And the Greeks, you know, faced with this great complex mass of people, picked up a name and Scythians and dumped it on them. So to some extent, rather like Celts, Scythians is a construct. But it's a construct that helps us contain our archaeology. And the remarkable thing to me is what Herodotus is telling us and other Greeks are telling us about the Scythians close to the Pontic steppe is so carefully matched by the archaeology of people right across this great swathe. So I think, you know, I periodically said Scythian-like or Scythian-style peoples, just to remind ourselves that the royal Siths were very special within this area. But the culture really does stretch from one end to the other.
Okay, you've got a question up there, and then we'll come to this one.
The superb level of their artwork, particularly their metalwork, does, to me, indicate some sort of sedentary civilization. Did someone sort of stay home and do the artwork?
Aha, yes. I suddenly panicked when I was looking at the time and cut out a bit. Quite a lot of the gold work we were looking at from the Pontic steppe area, there is a big debate about where it was made. The generally accepted view, it was made by Greek craftsmen for the Scythian elite. And these were the Greek craftsmen living around the Pontic steppe area. And the Greek view is that classical view is that these were Greek craftsmen living in the Greek cities, dealing with Scythian clients. Rather than Scythians themselves doing it. I think a better, possibly a more reasonable way of looking at it is that these were certainly Greek-trained craftsmen who were working specifically for a Scythian audience, but they could well have been in the entourages of the Scythian kings themselves. So in the same way as I showed you the Urartian gold and mentioned that they may have taken these craftsmen back. So the craft skills of the gold workers there, the metal workers, were very much Greek trained, but they were at enormous pains to depict the Scythians as different as they were, and as the sort of pictures we get from other sources as well. So the simple answer, probably Greek trained craftsmen for much of it, but when you get into the Altai Mountains, all that wonderful carved wood and so on, all that is native indigenous, done presumably by the craftspeople, men and women, in the winters when they're not out looking after the animals.
Okay, I think there was a question down here in the second row.
Do we know much about the role of women in these societies?
Yeah. Yes, we do. That's one of the very interesting things about Scythian society. They're much less, they were much more gender flexible than we Western societies until comparatively recently. The women among some of the Scythians, they were powerful women. There are queens mentioned as well as kings. And one queen killed Cyrus the Great and chopped off his head. The Sarmatians, we're told, one particular group of these Scythian-like peoples, had the rule that a female could not marry until she had killed an enemy first. And this is where we get the idea of the Amazon, you know, who cauterizing the breast so that it doesn't get in the way of the bowstring. The warrior female, and this one or two Greek writers pick up and talk about, and you do in the archaeology actually find this. You find female burials with all the warrior gear as well, so that females can easily move in to the warrior level. And become rulers in their own right. And similarly, the males, there are a group of males called effeminates, and they the Greek writers blame it on too much horse riding. Which may actually be true, these effeminates are people who are believed to have special powers, and these often become the priests and the shaman and have a real status in society. So, as I said, much more gender flexibility among the Scythians than one would have imagined in the ancient world.
Okay, I think we have one more question. There's just one here.
What do we know about their language?
It was an Indo-European language, and it was, they call it, it's related to the Iranian language branch of Indo-European, this would take a long time to go into in detail, but there is one view that Indo-European started in the steppe, and there is another view that Indo-European started south of the Caucasus, and I believe south of the Caucasus has it on a lot of new ancient DNA evidence, Indo-European language from the south of the Caucasus was spreading into the steppe in the 3rd millennium BC. So you get a lot of interaction there, and that's how I think the Indo-European reached the steppe land. And they were speaking a dialect of Indo-European at that stage, which was closely related to Iranian, which is sort of south of the Caucasus. So that's the basic answer.
That was Barry Cunliffe speaking at our 2019 History Weekend events. His book, The Scythians, Nomad Warriors of the Steppe, is out now, published by Oxford University Press. If you enjoyed this talk, we'll be running lectures from our history events every Saturday on the podcast for the next few weeks. And be sure to go to historyextra.com/events for news of our upcoming virtual lecture series. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow with an episode on everything you wanted to know about the suffragette.